My name is John Lundblad. I think I've gotten to see a lot of you at other times. I'm currently serving in Jerusalem as a pastor for the Lutheran Church in America, working at the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer, a German church in the middle of the old city of Jerusalem. I do all the work in English at the church there, which brings me into contact both with people who are living and working there for shorter or longer periods of time, plus tourists and pilgrims. Plus, I'm involved in a certain amount of ecumenical and interfaith work for both the ALC and the LCA. And just for the benefit of people who might ever listen to this on tape, we're talking about the current Middle East situation, which the situation that existed up until about the middle of the day on August 12th. Things change so rapidly that a discussion a week ago would be different from a discussion a week from now. I'd like to begin the forum with two kinds of information. One, just some background information on what we would call the Arab-Israeli conflict, and then maybe some specific information about what is happening now, and then just go into a bit as to what seems to be United States foreign policy going on in the Middle East. After that, maybe about 15 minutes or so, I'd like to just open up for questions and comments and discussion we have among the group as a whole as to your own thoughts or questions you might have about it. First, the roots of the conflict. Most of us often like to say something like, golly, those people, they've been fighting forever. There's just never going to be any peace in that part of the world. Well, I think it's more accurate historically for a Middle Easterner to look at Europe and say, you know, those people have been fighting for the last 200 years. There's just never going to be peace in Europe. Because if we could analyze Middle Eastern history for the last, say, 400 years, Turkish rule, the Ottoman Empire, came in by, say, the year 1450, a good year, 500 years ago. And that established the Ottoman Empire. And from that time on, it was the one empire. There were no more great wars of conquest that went through the Middle East. Granted, the Turkish rule was not a great rule. And the last century of it was, at times, just terrible. But it was relatively peaceful. At least as peaceful there as, say, the frontier society of the United States in most of the 19th century. In other words, the first wars that began in the Middle East began in, well, one date is 1798, when Napoleon invaded Egypt. And suddenly at the beginning of European powers fighting out their conflicts in the Middle East. And throughout the 19th century, you had much the same conflict of Europeans using the Middle East as a battleground. Or if not a battleground, at least a staging point. So you have the British and the French and the Germans and the Italians carving up North Africa, East Africa, the Middle East, and across to India into spheres of influence. Those spheres of influence led in 1914 to World War I, or not led to it, but those spheres of influence led in 1914 to some of that war, the Great War, being fought out in the Middle East. So you had the British inspiring with T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, inspiring the Sharif of Mecca to revolt and drive north to drive the Turks out of Saudi, out of Palestine, out of Jordan, Transjordan, out of Syria, and there was a British influence. And the promise was that if you do that, then we'll see about independence. The British and the French established new mandates. And then in 1939 to 1945, there was again the fighting of the European Civil War in North Africa and parts of the Middle East. So you had the Germans and the Italians fighting the British and the Americans and the Australians and God knows who else was on the Allied side on North Africa. And the Egyptians and the Algerians and the rest were almost incidental to the conflict. It was their territory. But we had the fighting out of essentially what was a European civil war. The first Middle Eastern war then has to be seen beginning in 1948 with the Israeli War of Independence. The next war, 1956, was the combined Israel, French, and British attack on Suez and on Egypt, which got the Americans terribly angry. The next war was 1967, which could be seen finally to be the first purely Middle Eastern war after 500 years. 1967, the so-called Six-Day War or the June War, the 1973 war called the Yom Kippur War or the October War, leading then to the 1978 Latani operation, the first invasion of by Israel into Lebanon, and they're seizing about 10 to 20 miles of territory inside Lebanon, and then the most recent invasion beginning June 6th of this year. The conflict has roots that are not easily established. Most books try to pick out a date, 1948, 1929, 1915, the 1890s, 1798, 1451, 1099. What we have is not a step at which you can say, here is where the problem begins, but rather a spiral of events. That, for example, if one talks about the problems in a city like Hebron on the West Bank, and begins to talk about the current problems, you begin very rapidly speaking about what happened in 1968, and after that you immediately start talking about what happened in 1929, and after that you start talking about what happened 1,000 years ago. And eventually, if you really want to take it back to a point of absurdity, you can take it back to Ishmael and Isaac not getting along as brothers. It's that kind of conflict. There's no obvious starting point at which you can say, here the problem begins, and you go from there. So you cannot go back to a point and say, now if we could only resolve this root problem, we could do it. People do that only by inflicting a biased view upon history and picking a point in history that happens to agree with our particular political standpoint. But we have to begin somewhere, so we would take as a more common point roughly 1890 and the beginning of what's sometimes called the Second Aliyah, or the second period, second major immigration of primarily Russian Jews from the Tsarist regime into Palestine and establishing the Yishuv, the early Jewish community, and the Arab, and then from there the Arab response beginning roughly, say, 1915, 1917, with the rise of Arab nationalism and Arab independence. You have two parallel movements which happen to be going on at the same time. One, a Jewish longing for a return to their homeland and the establishment of an independent Jewish state. That did not begin after 1945. That has to be seen as beginning in the last century. The Zionist dream beginning really with Theodor Herzl in the 1890s for a home in Israel for the Jewish people. There was a time when the British offered the Jewish people Uganda. Any of you ever know that? The British had Uganda and they wanted to do something with Uganda, and they wanted to do something with the Jews, and they figured, why not give Uganda to the Jews? Herzl said, well, maybe it's better than nothing, and he offered it, and all the, you know, the whole Jewish Congress just walked out on him, and he decided it wasn't a great idea after all, so they dropped it. You have that movement going on as an independent movement separate from consideration about the Arabs. Okay? You have that. At the same time, you have rising within the Arab world, especially with the establishments by the Presbyterians of Arab University in Beirut, and another one in Cairo, the developments of British and French rule, and the general reaction of the world to colonial authority in the examples of resistance in Africa and Asia and elsewhere, a rise in Arab nationalism, not just among Palestinians, but among the Lebanese and the Syrians and the Egyptians and the Algerians and the Moroccans and everybody else, beginning to say, hey, you know, we don't want the British and the French and the Italians and the Germans. We want our home rule, okay? So you had the development of Arab nationalism, not initially opposed to the Jewish group, but opposed to a colonial rule. So you have two parallel movements, which finally, in the case of the Palestinians, begin to veer together because they happen to be speaking about the same piece of ground, the piece of ground that we all call the Holy Land. And that's where the two movements come together. Two independent, two separate movements which finally clash because they begin talking about a Palestinian state as the fulfillment of Arab nationalism and a Jewish state as the fulfillment of the Zionist ideal, and they both clash because they're talking about the same piece of ground. Okay. Therein lies, as simply as possible, the beginnings of what we would call the modern conflict. Two people with equally legitimate aims, goals, dreams, aspirations, hopes, all the words, who run into each other because they're talking about the same piece of ground. What complicates the problem are two other factors. One, that especially post-1945, the Western world begins to face up to the question of what happened in World War II with the Holocaust. And at least a tentative thought of saying, well, golly, you know, the Jews do deserve some place. You know, after all that happened to them in Europe, the Western European powers post-1945 had neither the moral will nor the physical strength to do anything about a Middle Eastern conflict. And would just, I think we have to admit how worn out, how many of you went through World War II? And people got tired in those 6 years. And when 1945 came, nobody was terribly interested in the world's problems. What was everybody interested in? Going home, getting a job, getting the family going, all the good things that ostensibly we'd all been fighting for in the war, and so let's get about doing it. No one really wanted to get involved in all those new conflicts. The British are a great example. They were tired, and hence the beginnings of the pullback. At the same time, everybody kind of saying, well, the Jews do deserve some place, and the whole Palestine is as good a place as any because it is their land. And so begin to get this confusion about the place. And that's the first major item, is that there's a confusion about the Middle East that we still all feel. The second major item is that immediately post-1945, the Middle East becomes a battleground of the world powers. Because late in 1945 and 1946 and 1947, the Soviet Union makes its first move into the Middle East with an attempt to annex part of Iran, and a major threat to control Iran. And the United States says, we can't let you do that. If you don't pull out of Iran, you know, we're going to go to war. Unfortunately, everybody had been demobilized by then, so there wasn't much to go to war with, and nobody really wanted to. But that was beginning of this, of the Middle Eastern conflict by the superpowers, which extended itself even more with the need for energy. And as the resources in the West, Western Europe, and North America began to decline, everybody began looking and said, there's a lot of oil in Egypt and Saudi and Iraq and Iran. And those suddenly are becoming part of our national interest. And we have to protect those because our economy begins to be necessarily dependent upon those resources. So we've maintained that. Two things. One, we're all somewhat confused about the Middle East because we have a lot of conflicting emotions, beginning by the fact that it is the Holy Land, although we really don't know what we mean by that. It is kind of special to us because people have been talking to us about it ever since we first heard the Christmas story How many of you can remember the first time somebody told you about Jerusalem or Bethlehem? You were 2, 3 years old? You read it on Christmas Eve? We've heard that geography more than any other geography lessons in the world. Now, maybe nobody ever showed you a map, but those places are imprinted on our minds as being somehow important to us. So we have that confusion. We have the continuing conflict of the superpowers. Remember when President Carter made his speech about the Middle East, 4 years ago now, which led to the establishment of the Rapid Deployment Force? One of the lines he said is that it's necessary for us to protect our interests in the Middle East. That may make sense to us, but if you listen to that kind of statement with Middle Eastern ears, it's a threat. In other words, if you don't really do things quite our way, we're going to have to protect you. We did that once before, 1958, when the Marines first landed in Lebanon. And evidently somebody took out those plans and looked at them again, because they weren't bad plans for the next for the arrival of the next contingent. So people in the Middle East do worry about, you know, a possible attempt by the Western powers to control them. It shows up in very recently in the establishment of the Rapid Deployment Force. You know that we have a battalion of the 82nd Airborne out of Fort Bragg serving in the Sinai right now as part of the peacekeeping force. You all know the peacekeeping force is part of the Israel-Egypt treaty, which says that for a certain period of time the United States and other nations will have a peacekeeping force in the Sinai to protect the two sides from each other. So the 82nd Airborne happens to be the United States' contribution to that peacekeeping force. The 82nd Airborne also happens to have another very interesting part of its mission. It's part of the Rapid Deployment Force, which is what President Carter would say would be available for use if needed in the Middle East. They're now serving on an advanced base. Now, we may not think that. We're saying, well, it's kind of coincidental. The Middle East doesn't really believe it's a coincidence. And they just kind of say it's a lot easier to get them from the Sinai to a Saudi than to get them from Fort Bragg to Saudi. It shows up in another way. Right now, our arms salesmen around the world have new brochures. Well, hypothetical statement, I don't know, and don't get. If some of you work for these industries, I mean this is hypothetical, or that our arms salesmen are going around with new brochures which say, did you see what our tanks did to the Russian tanks? Did you see what our planes did to the Russian planes? Did you see what our anti-aircraft equipment did to their anti-aircraft batteries? Did you see, you know, all the way along? It's a comparison. But they're not talking about Americans using American weaponry against the Soviet Union using Soviet weaponry. They're talking about this trial war in which the Israelis are using American weaponry and the Syrians were using Soviet weaponry, and the Soviets on the one side and the Americans on the other side got to see how the weapons actually functioned in combat. Neither the Russians nor the Americans have really had that kind of, like, a tank war for a long time. So how does the tank function in battle? You know, we'd like to see. And you can't go out and attack somebody with a tank easily. And you can't engage a mock tank battle. You don't really want to blow up your own tanks. So it means that they can go out and say, this war proves that our arms are superior to their arms. So if you're smart in Asia, Africa, Latin America, you'll buy our weapons because they're better than their weapons, and this war proves it. So we have this continuing conflict of the superpowers and the interest of the superpowers. Now, lest I say that, you know, in purely, you know, what sounds anti-American, the Russians are probably going around with their new brochures which said it's not the problem with the equipment, this is what the Syrians did wrong. So it means that, you know, it's equally a Russian sphere of concern as it is a North American sphere of concern. So it is not as though you have only one major superpower involved. You have both of them. And they're both fighting for control. And you get a place like Egypt that is under Soviet control, and then it's under American control, and then there's the possible drift back to Soviet control. So both powers are trying to say, you know, who do we have? You know, we have Israel and kind of Jordan and Saudi and Egypt, and they've got Syria and maybe Iraq and Iran. God knows who's got Iran. God knows who wants Iran right now. And Lebanon's a basket case, and Turkey's a mess with its own problem. So it's kind of a standoff right now. And if we could only get Syria, you know, so it becomes not just a question of Middle East peace, but especially as the way President Reagan will speak, the Middle East is looked on not as a problem in and of itself, but as a part of the United States global strategy. In other words, the Arab-Israeli conflict is kind of our war against their war. And the Israelis have to win because we can't afford to let them be defeated, because that would mean a Soviet victory. So it's the Americans and the Soviets again engaging in surrogate war going on in another way. Three more minutes just on the current conflict, and then my last corollary condition. The current conflict, for those of you that haven't wanted to look at a paper, beginning about a week ago, there were strong implications that an agreement was coming to pass. By the way, if there's anybody in the United States today who deserves a Medal of Honor just for sheer valor, it's Philip Habib, who's an Idaho boy, by the way, and made his way through college by cheating at poker, and was originally a forestry student, and happened to take a foreign service examination along with a forestry examination, and the foreign service offer came through first. If the forestry offer had come through first, he might have ended up as the Holden guard. That man, Philip Habib, if you haven't read anything about him, he's retired, he's almost 70, he's had 4 heart attacks in his life. He's currently been going strong for the last, I think it's 40 days now, shuttling back and forth, basically listening to people and not listening to them whenever they say anything angry, anything negative, anything that doesn't fit. He just keeps talking. And people keep yelling at him and telling him, no, we won't do it. And he says, well, we'll talk some more about it. And he keeps going around everybody until I think they're finally so tired of talking to him that they figure better peace than another day with Philip Habib. Beginning, though, about a week ago, it seemed as though the conflict were coming closer to a tentative resolution with a number of Arab countries willing to take the PLO. France and Italy had agreed also to put in peacekeeping forces. The idea was for a 15-day transition period with a phased withdrawal of the Palestinian and Syrian, of initially the Palestinian forces from Beirut, and a phased entry of the peacekeeping forces. Once the peacekeeping force was in place, then negotiations for a steady and mutual withdrawal by the Syrians and the Israelis. I went back tonight and just looked back at it. Sunday's paper was kind of negative. Monday's was, maybe something's happening. Tuesday was more positive, and Wednesday's paper was practically announcing a new agreement, and Thursday's paper announced the worst bombing that Israel had given to Beirut in 2 months of war. 10 hours of bombing by air, sea, and land forces. That evidently, when President Reagan heard it Thursday morning, Washington time, called Begin directly and evidently said in no uncertain terms it was absolutely impossible for Habib to continue at all if there were that. And as it turned out, at least the papers here reported that the bombing had been ordered by Minister of Defense Sharon without consultation with political authorities in Jerusalem. And as a result of that, the Lebanese and other parties to the negotiations immediately broke off negotiations until a new ceasefire will come into effect, which hopefully was today. So the frustration level in the Middle East is high. The confusion level is even higher. And so my final corollary before I stop talking is simply this, that if you feel at all confused about the Middle East, please feel very much at home and very much at ease, because it is terribly confusing. And it's, if you try to think of it in terms of justice and righteousness for all people, you only end up being confused. And if you try to think of it as trying to fit all the pieces of the puzzle into place, you either have the impression of putting together a puzzle that somebody took away the picture on the front of the carton, and incidentally you're doing it upside down, or somebody's given you all the pieces from leftover puzzles that have ever been spilled on the floor, and none of the pieces will ever firmly match with everybody else. But you have to make a picture out of it. And then you get an idea of the confusion of the Middle East. And don't eliminate the confusion, because once you eliminate the confusion, you've eliminated the possibility of understanding the situation. Enough of my talking. I think questions or concerns or comments or discussion in the group would be where I'd rather go at this point. Yeah?
Wasn't the Ottoman Empire one of the most oppressive, keeping people really in ignorance? And as you indicated, and I know your point was to set the stage that there was not a lot of war, but they kept most of those people in absolute total servitude.
In the last century, this is particularly true.
So when they left, there was a vacuum in terms of leadership and any kind of middle class or educated people to operate.
Yeah, the last century of Ottoman rule is not to be remembered. If you can talk about the early rule, the 15th and 16th century, just some monumental artworks, poetic works on interest, but the last century and the final pashas and rulers were just unenlightened, uneducated, despotic villains. So I have nothing good to say about the ones from about 1870 on, which you're right there, but it's, I think up until, say, 1800, there wasn't terribly bad rule. Not much worse than a lot of what Europe had had during the same period of time. But your point's well taken. The last century is bad. Yeah?
Is there really any place there to establish a Palestinian homeland? That seems to be the crux of all the problems. Palestinians want a homeland too. Is there any land available there that could be designated for that purpose?
There could be. And basically, we're talking about the West Bank and the Gaza. That would depend on, one, the Israelis accepting the existence of an independent Palestinian state, which they have been unwilling to do, and two, it would mean an acceptance by the Palestinians that they are not going to go back home to Haifa and Jaffa and West Jerusalem, and they've been unwilling to accept that reality. One of the arguments often is that the West Bank economically is not a viable entity as an independent entity. That's true. It could not exist independently. Nor can Israel, nor can the Soviet Union, nor can the United States. We have developed such an international, interdependent economy that unless we were willing radically to change our lifestyle, we couldn't do it. Now, Holden can't exist as an independent economically without radically changing what Holden would be. You can't bring up all these guests in the summer without having that barge show up regularly from the outside world. And in a sense, that's the way of the nations of the world. We all need those barges coming in and going out. So the West Bank could exist. It would need a certain amount of international aid and support, but Israel requires $2.2 to $3 billion a year from the United States.
So it's the West Bank now.
West Bank is populated by approximately 1.1 million Arabs and last counts about 20,000 to 25,000 Israelis in the settlements. Though primarily two very large settlements near Jerusalem and Hebron, and then another 8,000 scattered in little hamlet settlements everywhere. So, and the Arabs are not citizens of Israel, they are residents of the occupied territories. And there is certainly no move within Israel to countenance an independent Palestinian state. There's a much stronger move for annexation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you tie this in to our, bring it up to date as far as biblical standpoint? Prophecy has to fit in here somehow. The Israelis are being driven by, I believe, God himself to do what they're doing, being backed by the United States, which has been, you might as well say, a Christian nation, been known as that. But anyway, we're behind the Jewish people. Our government is behind them. And I feel this is all tying in somehow with prophecy and what God has intentions for the last latter days. Now, do you have anything on this? Are you familiar with George Otis over there, or the CBN?
Yeah.
Or what's going on over there in this particular area?
Yeah, I am. I have to admit a bias. I cannot support George Otis and his work at all. He's causing tremendous problems for Arab Christians. And I am. Because it means that the Arab world is increasingly distrusting the Arab Christians. Because they just say, well, you know, listen to broadcast like come out of people like George Otis, who say the Christians are supporting Israel, and it just makes the position of Christians in places like Egypt and Jordan and Syria and Iraq and elsewhere very, very difficult. I have a basic problem in seeing the existence of the modern state of Israel at all related to biblical prophecy. I think I just cannot make a connection. If someone else wants to respond to that, I would rather not, because I think I come out fairly biased in myself, and since I am leading this forum, I do not want to come out on that. But I just enough to say that I can't make that connection for myself. I can make a connection between Christians and Jews, and I can make a connection in God's plan of salvation and redemption for the people of God, but I do not see that as being dependent upon either the modern state of Israel or on the existence of the United States of America. That's, would anybody want to respond to that?
Yeah. Dorothea Peter is one of our missionaries in the United Presbyterian Church that's lived most of her adult life in Beirut. It's still in West Beirut. And she would hold, I think, the same position that you do. Very, very strong in terms of her commitment to the Christian Arab community in Lebanon. And feeling that much of our understanding in the United States comes an awful lot from the press that does not relate fairly what's happening in the Arab community, especially among Christians.
Anybody else want to respond or raise, raise a question?
This is a different time.
Yeah. Okay.
And I know it's awkward, but I was dismayed to hear you feel that this was sort of a puppet war between the United States and the Soviet Union. I thought it was more the government of Israel against the Arab states or the people of the PLO. And I was wondering, to what extent do you think that it's a puppet war?
Puppet war, I think, might be a little strong. I don't think that there was ever an order by the United States to Israel to go to war. How much the United States was involved in the preparation or the planning of it, I don't know. I'll plead ignorance. I don't think anybody who does know would certainly not say. I don't think that the Israelis ever asked permission, or that they ever had someone like Secretary of State Haig or President Reagan who said, sure, go ahead, However, you remember when President Reagan the European heads of state had gathered for the Great Conference, and the war erupted. And evidently one of the heads of state was reminded of the fact that the last time they had gotten together, Israel had also launched an attack, and one of them asked facetiously if maybe it would not be easier for them if they invited Begin to come to the next conference, so that at least it would not happen while they were all together. But after Reagan, President Reagan left the European travels, he went to Great Britain, and he addressed the Houses of Parliament. And this was in the second week of June, The Israeli ambassador to London had been assassinated on June 4th. The Israelis began their attack on June 6th. President Reagan spoke to the Houses of Parliament sometime that week. I think it was about June 10th. But it was at a time when the war was still somewhat limited. And President Reagan, in his speech before the Houses of Parliament, said two things that pertain particularly to the conflict, or at least were interpreted by Middle Eastern people as pertaining to the conflict. The first one was that he said, the democracies of the world have got to stick together. Which is a good statement. I can accept that. And Israel would say, well, yeah, we can accept that because we're a democracy and the democracies of the world have got to stick together. Therefore, they say the United States is allying itself with all other democratic states. Okay. Another major statement that President Reagan made before the Houses of Parliament, corollary, whether he said this specifically because of the Middle East conflict or because it had been written into the speech long before, I don't know. He said that one of the greatest dangers, if not the greatest dangers facing the democracies of the world today, is the threat of international terrorism. And in at least Israeli language, international terrorism is a code phrase for the PLO. And so the Israelis would say the President of the United States has said the democracies of the world are united in opposition to international terrorism. Therefore, the United States is supporting Israeli activity in eliminating the PLO as an agent of terrorism. And they move north. Now, whether or not that was a planned speech, a planned cue, or not, it certainly had the effect. And from that, the Arabs in the Middle East firmly believe that the United States backs, if not totally supports, the Israeli invasion into Lebanon. And so I think we're dealing with one thing, American foreign policy and the way that foreign policy appears to the Middle Eastern nations. American foreign policy, by the way, toward the Middle East has always been a mixture, wanting to be friendly with the Arab states because of the oil, wanting to support Israel because of our common heritage, and because it is a democratic state, which it is. I have no difficulty admitting, saying that and reminding us all that it is, without doubt, one of the democracies in the Middle East. So the United States has wanted to be friendly with the Arabs, it's wanted to support Israel, and it's wanted to have peace. And it's wanted to make sure that the Russians don't move in. And you try to mix all four of those together and you can never quite do it. It's like wanting to have, peach and chocolate pie. And they're both good, and neither one is bad. It's just when you mix them together. Yeah.
Do you think the Israelis that have the bomb, what difference does this make to the Middle East?
Prime Minister Begin has it's a problem when the names are so close in sounding. It was easier when you had Carter and Begin, but to have Begin and Reagan, it comes so close. So if I make a mistake, please. I am not trying to make a political comment. I just get tongue twisted. Prime Minister Begin has said on a number of occasions that Israel would not be the first one to use nuclear weapons in the Middle East. I would make an assumption that if Israel does not actually have a bomb, in a corner somewhere, they would have the people, the technology, the information, the equipment, and the necessary fissionable material to assemble one within a reasonable period of time. That's an assumption I am making. I cannot back that up with factual evidence. But it's a common assumption of most people, and so I do not think that they have any nuclear weapons flying around in an airplane ready to drop on West Beirut. Nor do I think that has even been considered by Israeli. But when you take fine nuclear scientists from Europe and North America, and you take the kind of technology the Israelis have and the kind of nuclear abilities, the assumption is you get that kind of people together, you have enough people who know how to make one.
The problem is the balance of power would shift against the Israelis and they might be tempted to.
This is the one great threat. If the Israelis were finally pushed to the wall, one of the fears is, what is the morals, what moral strength can be required of people who were almost destroyed? In other words, can we require the Israelis to have the same moral strength with respect to nuclear weaponry than we could expect of ourselves? When they can speak about the 6 million people who were killed in the Holocaust, can they be required to face destruction as a moral question in the same way we would? That's a problem in my mind right now. I'm not quite sure how much to lay that on them. Yeah.
Another subject. You've indicated it. I'd like to press it a little further. Is our manner of life in America such that, and our dependence on oil out of those areas such that if that was cut off for various reasons, we would go in militarily to ensure that we could get it?
I don't know. I think we as a nation have surprised ourselves by our conservation in the last 5 years. And we've cut our intake of oil by hundreds of thousands of barrels a day. And I think that surprised us. I remember when I served in Utah, I was in a little town, Brigham City, northern Utah. And 2 years ago when we were on home leave, we visited some friends back there. And we were talking about, things. And we got around to the question of electricity and conservation. They all started laughing because the local electric company, which buys, the city runs its little electric corporation and it buys electricity out of an intermountain grid, and they have to pay a certain rate for it. Well, the oil, they were all saying, wow, you've all got to conserve and you've all got to cut down. So everybody did. They cut down so much that the electric company had to raise the rates because they couldn't sell enough electricity to the town anymore. And that's happened to us all. I think we've all had that with water and everything. I think we've surprised ourselves that we can get along with less, and I think we're learning it slowly. I think we're constantly tempted to go back to an easier lifestyle and use a little more electricity, a little more gas, a little bigger car all the time. And I'm not sure if the conservation is linked to a reaction of saying we've got to conserve, or the fact that we're all facing, one way or another, something of a recession and we want to save. In other words, would we be as willing to conserve if it were a high economy? I don't know, but I don't think the oil threat is as much of a threat as we sometimes say. Like, for example, an oil embargo, the damage to the Middle Eastern countries would be fantastic by an oil embargo. And it's a question as to which, we face that with the question of the grain embargo. Who got hurt more in the grain embargo to the Soviet Union? The Soviet Union or the farmers of the Midwest? We've tried the embargo, President Reagan tried the embargo on the pipeline. And Europe said, well, that's interference in our own local affairs. And the pipeline embargo, if you follow the news, has collapsed. Not because we're opposed to it, but because Britain, France, Italy, and Germany, all the prime contractors using our technology, which they happen to have as part of their companies now, are not going to honor the embargo. So it's almost irrelevant. So I think, and for the, if you followed the last OPEC meeting, was a shambles. OPEC has not been able to come to a rational discussion of rates. Their cartel, as it was, collapsed about a year ago, and their last three meetings have all ended in chaos, and they all go home and are just unable to discuss a new rate policy. So if Saudi decided to institute an embargo, the Iraqis would simply sell more oil. I don't think we have that kind of unity in the Middle Eastern Arab nations anymore. Yeah.
I don't understand what the Iran and the Iraqs are fighting about. Do you have any comment on that?
Is anybody else? Seriously. Can any of you remember what they went to war over? Yeah.
Well, it was interesting. I've heard the story from both sides, from the Iraqis and Iranians. It's pretty different. the Iranians say, at least the ones I talked to. I should think it out before I say it, so I can do justice to what their story was. That the Iraqis wanted to expand their border a little bit into Iran, basically. This is what the Iranians say. And they flew over with some surprise bombers headed towards Tehran on a total surprise attack. And these bombers were coming across over the border. They flew into Iranian airspace. And some Iranian Air Force pilots who just happened to be up on maneuvers doing some routine something saw these bombers coming and immediately radioed to Tehran and informed them of this. And so they were able to dissuade those bombers from reaching the capital of Iran. They say that if Iraq was able to have made that complete surprise attack on Iran, perhaps such as something that happened at Pearl Harbor, that if the Iraqis were successful, they could have immediately crippled the leadership and achieved their purpose. But because it failed, it kind of launched into the conflict. And Iran was very strong militarily and was able then to, you know, fight back very successfully. And then neither side was willing to in any way kind of call an end to it. And that's kind of the Iranian side. I don't remember so much how the Iraqis respond to it, except that they're extremely in support of their country's right to have that expansion too. And, you know, they feel it's rightfully there. So as in most cases in the Middle East, it appears to be a, you know, the same kind of issue of right to land.
Yeah. If you look at a map of the Middle East, and any of you who get National Geographic, go back and find some of the Middle Eastern map, and you'll find scattered around the Middle East dotted lines. Like there's one between Iraq and Kuwait. It's a little diamond. And the lines, the international border runs a nice, straight, hard black line to this point. And then there's a dotted diamond. And it's simply labeled disputed territory. And Kuwait believes that they own to the top of the diamond, and Iraq believes that they own to the bottom of the diamond. That's one of the conflicts. There's another conflict between the two Yemens over territory. If you go down to the United Arab Emirates, you get all dotted lines which exist in the desert, in which border marking points are irrelevant because the sand dunes cover them, and in which you know, they will equally claim territory from Saudi, from Oman, from anybody else. So there are, read an article once, there are currently 10, in addition to the Arab-Israeli conflict and the current Iran-Iraq conflict, there are 8 other border disputes in the Middle East which could erupt into war. Why Iran and Iraq? Literally, it's come to the point now that Iraq tried to invade to gain territory. Iran collapsed for a while, but then they released all of their American-trained fighter pilots from prison, fixed up all their planes with spare parts that they got from Israel, and they went to war. It's funny. It's another place where we have the Iranians who have American-trained pilots with American equipment fighting Iraqis with Soviet-trained pilots and Soviet equipment, and it's, both sides hate the Russians and the Americans, but it's another funny interim or global war. And Iraq finally said, you know, we're not going to make it. They were just hitting these waves of Iranian volunteers. And so they said, okay, we'll withdraw. So they withdrew, and Iran invaded. And, you know, almost on national honor. And I have not read anything in the last 2 weeks about the war. It quieted down for a while, partly because the Iranians, when they invaded, Iraqis did a classic military maneuver of, you know, this, you know, the three wings, and the center is the weak wing, and you pull back, and the forces just drive ahead, and the top and bottom wing come together, and they evidently, you know, slaughtered like some like 10,000 Iranian troops in one day, just in crossfire.
They were doing almost bondage charges.
Yeah. It's a crazy situation, and what they are fighting over now is war.
Is it all?
I have no better explanation than that. That's a particular word that I have a great confusion.
It's almost a religious word now.
Anatolia
Khomeini wants to take out the Iraqi leader.
Right, yeah. Yeah, he sees them as a heretic
it's
and a...
Two sects of Muslims fighting against...
Yeah, so it's to eliminate them.
That was my question. Oh. What extent it's religious sectarian...
There is, because you have the conflict between the Shiites and the Sunni, and even more between this rise of, or the resurgence of a conservative Islam facing, you know, what they feel has been the secular forces and the Marxist forces and the westernizing forces that have been active in a country like Iraq, and they say, we have to cleanse Iraq of all of that.
Do you hear anything about human rights that Iraq's, does Iraq claim that they're concerned about human rights in Iran to restore them? Or?
Only in as they tend to defend their own policy. So Iraq would say that one of the reasons they went to war was to protect the rights of the what's sometimes called the Marsh Arabs. Some relatively simple people, and I don't mean simple in an uneducated sense, but a traditional kind of life down in the southern end of the Euphrates, who live in what's a marsh area, and they tend to be fisher folk, but they tend to be Arab rather than Persian, and they tend to be Iranian by nationality. And Iraq said, you know, by golly, we've got to protect their rights. You know, like it or not, we're going to protect them.
I'd like to underscore something I think that might elude us in, you know, in the conflicts we brought up, the two superpowers being engaged in, I think it was October 26, 1981 issue of Time. They had a whole issue devoted to arming the world. And they made an interesting little comment that since World War II, there have been 130 conflicts in the world that could be classified as wars, and 90% of those fought in third world countries by weapons supplied by the major powers. The figure that they didn't include in that is that there were 30 million people killed in those 130 wars, and then they went on to show that since 1975, this country has been the major supplier of arms to the world. We passed Russia in 1975. That happens to coincide with the time we left Vietnam. I think to keep our economy going, we turn that production instead of to peaceful means to continue armaments, the supply of armaments. And our government just recently released a study which shows that in the last 10 years, we are not the major suppliers in the world, which I think is an act of extreme cynicism, because over the 10-year period, that's correct. But since 1975, we have replaced the Soviet Union in that rather, I think, shameful market. And I think if we're concerned about peace, I mean, like one of the points you make is we can't figure out whose side we're on. And part of it has to do with we're the prophet for us as a nation. And I don't lay that just on our military and industrial complex. But because we would have to pay an enormous price in terms of unemployment and transition in our workforce, and I don't see us as being terribly willing as citizens to pay the economic price for peace, even in a conventional sense. And so, I think these things just heighten. For me, what it means to be a peacemaker is to watch all of the kind of things. And I'm from an area in Puget Sound. It profits enormously from sales of armaments, AWACS airplanes and Boeing turns out missiles and all other kinds of things. So that, I don't think that's confusing a lot.
Well, to underscore what you were speaking about, a book came out, I forget the publishing date, entitled A Report from Iron Mountain. And Iron Mountain was a code name for a think tank in back east. And under Eisenhower, a study group was gotten together that had full power to use military people, corporate interests. They had a huge computer. And the question was, could the U.S. economy survive on a peacetime basis? And the answer was, no. We have to have an enemy. And so we have enemies all over the world. We can sell munitions because, cynically, our economy is more important than the lives of people. Period. And so, along with that military, though, we get back to the oil that we're talking about, and we really don't know what the true picture is, because the oil situation is told to us by corporate interests who are interested in money. And so they wouldn't mind millions of people dying if they could defend their oil interests. And that creates your war situation too, and complicating an already complicated situation, you run into the a boundary situation where most of those boundaries there were enforced by European interests, spheres of influence between French and British, and then the land gets sacrosanct, and as we were just talking about, Iran and Iraq are willing to give all kinds of lives to defend, except for the Shah al-Arab at the mouth of the Euphrates and Tigris, the rest of it's useless. And we think of boundaries as being very stable, like between Canada and the U.S. The boundary between, I'll throw in a complication here away from you to show the situation, the boundary between Uruguay and Argentina was very stable for years until oil was discovered. And then the boundary did not run right through that nice straight line going out the Atlantic. Argentina wanted to push it way up towards Uruguay, and Uruguay wanted to push it down towards Argentina. And so in the Middle East, it's very difficult to determine boundaries, and if you can't determine boundaries, you can't establish peace. And if you can't establish peace, you're going to have war.